few years ago, pianist Jeremy Denk put together an 80-minute recital at Lincoln Center. It spanned 700 years of Western music. Was it a stunt? No, not really. He was sharing a thought-provoking story of the constantly emerging possibilities of musical styles and expression. His new recording is called Circa 1300 to Circa 2000, and it allows you to experience the evolution of this musical arc through the voices of 24 different composers. That's the recording you'll hear about this week on New Classical Tracks from American Public Media. I'm Julie Almacher. Enjoy. I'm talking with pianist Jeremy Denk, who's released a new recording which spans 700 years of classical music. Jeremy, I'm looking at the title of this recording, and it's a little academic. Now, I might look at that and go, is this for me?
We were looking for something that just was about time, you know. We weren't trying to be academic exactly. It's hard to know when the first piece was actually written, so that's why it says circa 1300. It's sort of from the mists of time, and hopefully the album is about the sort of poetry, the sadness, in a way, of time passing. The mixture of, you know, one amazing human achievement after another, but then with each achievement that happens, something else from the past can no longer be repeated. You know, there's something about the development of style over all that time. Constant attainment and constant loss. So it has this life and death feeling, which is why the dates, I wanted it to look a little bit like the dates of being born and dying, which is a kind of a bummer, but...
It is kind of a bummer. It is sort of, though, related to a midlife crisis or two or three, right? That you have related to in your liner notes about the recording?
Well, yeah, it's funny because I was... They asked me about what sort of project I was interested in, and I had to tell them that I felt, as I was in middle age, that music history, the sweep of it, felt more important to me than it had, you know? I loved it. It was a cool thing when I was a student in Oberlin when I was 16, 17. And it sort of passed out of my consciousness for a little while, like classes often do. And that's when I started thinking about it more and why it was so important and so beautiful, the story, the unfolding story of all those centuries. You know, we often talk about classical music like it's a bin in the record store or a category, you know. And I think that part of my goal was to remind people of the tremendous time span of classical music and the way that people worked, in a way, on top of each other, one step at a time to find style after style. It's a story of culture and human thought over time.
This actually started as a recital, right, at mm-hmm. Lincoln Center. Tell me how, when you were asked to do this project in that setting, that this seemed like the right project.
Well, I proposed the idea to them, not necessarily thinking they would love it, but they were interested. I was like, well, wouldn't it be amazing to hear this whole story in one sitting, sort of experience it through a curated time-lapse photography situation and feel the cycle of all these years and all these geniuses, you know, working off of each other. So it's because it's their fault that this happened.
So this was at Lincoln Center.
Lincoln Center was the, they were the original proposers.
Part of the White Light Festival, mm-hmm. which is looking for progressive ideas.
Yeah, and things that are classical concerts that nonetheless have a little bit more of a dramatic element. And to me, the story of history like this is extremely dramatic. And it has these terrible impasses and these amazing climaxes of achievement, you know, of compositional fervor and things. And then there are these places where it seems like, well, what will we do next? How do we write now, you know?
And you were doing this in about 80 minutes. You were telling 700 years yes. of history in 80 minutes. Mm-hmm. How did you decide what was going to represent each of these periods? I mean, that to me doesn't seem as easy as it perhaps looks on paper.
it's not at all easy, and of course it's impossible. You know, I had to make choices, and every choice is a loss and a compromise. But I tried to choose pieces that were interesting to listen to and that represented some of the themes of music history's development that I was interested in. The beginning, it's about counterpoint. You know, what happens when you take a Gregorian chant and then you put a second voice with it? And how do the voices, and what do we do with the third voice? You know, so the first three tracks are two voices and then three voices and then four voices. And I tried to feel like how the composers begin to explore these different voices singing together and what that does. I made the choices partly based on a kind of a dramatic sense of how the recital would evolve. And the beginning is fairly atmospheric and slower and sparer, you know, and then as you gather towards the Renaissance and Baroque, there's more virtuosity. There's more, you know, notes for notes' sake, and there's a lot more density of harmony and things. And then there's a moment where it gets simple again at Mozart. And we try to sort of start again from a different point of view. Anyway, that's how I chose, a little bit historically and a little bit personally.
You brought up counterpoint, and you refer to that as the superpower of music. Tell me more about this superpower of music and how it's labeled as such. Well, especially if it's somebody who might not know what it is.
Right. People are often nervous talking about even harmony, like what's a C major chord, or, you know, unless you've studied a little bit. And counterpoint is even worse, the people you talk about it. But if you sing, say, Row, Row, Row Your Boat, and then somebody else comes in a little bit later also singing Row, Row, Row Your Boat, you're already doing counterpoint of a certain kind. Anytime more than one voice is interacting, you're creating counterpoint, and then there's all these disciplines of ways of making the voices interact with each other. Sometimes the two voices can feel tense against each other, like they're dissonant. And sometimes it's consonant, like they agree. Right? And there's all kinds of degrees of this tension and release. In when you have two voices. And when you put three voices together, it gets even more exponentially refined, all this art of counterpoint. And it's such an important part of the Western classical tradition. It's so eloquent, and so there's so much complexity and expression that gets unleashed from this simple, almost mathematical adding of one voice to another.
And, of course, the ultimate expression of that, I think most of us think of Bach as being, mm-hmm. like, the king of counterpoint. And Bach is represented in the course of your 700 years, which would be expected, kind of somewhere in the middle there.
Well, he comes at the end of the first big... it sort of comes to a contrapuntal climax with Bach, the great master. But he's also a great master of harmony, and then that changes the musical focus. After Bach, everything... the counterpoint is less evident, and the story of chords and which chords, how they react with each other, that becomes more important. And these are like music history themes that you learn in class, but they're also incredibly important for how we feel the music.
It's interesting to me because I think that is something else that you noted, that the way you feel about this and the emotional expression is almost more important to you now than it was when you were first exploring all this. Is that right?
Yeah. I played the recital a lot of times, and it had an increasingly emotional effect on me. I was aiming for something a little bit like the Goldberg Variations, where you begin with the simple, quote-unquote simple theme, and then you do all these amazing riffs on it, and you come back to where you began. And I found it very, like, here we've traveled through all this centuries, and there's something that you've lost, you know, along the way.
Do you want to talk about any of the other individual composers? Like, there's several at the very beginning,
sure.
that may not be that familiar, mm-hmm. to listeners from the Renaissance period and earlier than that. Because let's talk about where you start and that gradual progression in the first half.
in a way, Machaut is the end of the medieval period. So we're beginning sort of at the climax or the... So many music historians might get miffed about that. But what I started with was a little song by Machaut. It's about, you know, love and loss, kind of a troubadour style lyric. And then comes Binchois. Another song, and he was a mostly secular songs, and this song is one of his most famous, Triste Plaisir, which is somewhat about love and somewhat about sex, intermixed. You know, it has a sense of, and it keeps circling around this one B flat, trying to find its way to it. So there's something haunting about it. And then we come to, of course, as I remember, Ockeghem. An incredibly austere Renaissance composer. And this piece is a kind of a marvel of rhythmic complications, which is all hidden behind the surface because it all sounds beautiful and liquid and gorgeous. But he's done all these incredibly mathematical relationships between the voices. Then comes Dufay. Dufay, who is a little bit later Renaissance and a little... And this is kind of a almost relief from the austerity of what came before. And then Josquin. And he's one of the great Renaissance masters. So that piece, which was very famous and begins to look forward to the more narrative drive. You know, a lot of these earlier pieces are a little bit more circular. They sound like the melodies have this way of wandering elegantly about themselves. And with the Josquin, who's a great Renaissance master, you begin to feel this sense of the acceleration of the excitement from the beginning to the end of the piece, which is why I was after that element. So for the first five pieces, from the medieval to the Renaissance, and from a sense of a slightly looser form to this kind of more Western, what we would call Western narrative ideal. They don't have exciting biographical stories to my to my mind, but their importance has to do with their mastery of the languages that they inhabited.
Well, it's also interesting because you were choosing songs as mm-hmm. opposed to pieces that were written for a keyboard, right?
Yes. There wasn't really music. I mean, there was organ. This I learned while I was doing the CD, that the organ existed as early as 900, which shocked me. There were keyboard instruments. But, you know, the music that's most representative of that period is vocal music, always. That's why I say more than one voice. So you hear... It's like taking a plain chant and adding another. They started with a plain chant, a Gregorian chant, and then they'd add a voice with it, you know, doubling it or shadowing it or anchoring it. And then gradually the voices become more and more independent, you know, and that's part of the story.
A I like the way the Scarlatti comes in, and it's introducing a whole new form, but it has this brightness to it, the kind of a little more levity, perhaps.
I tried in the first half that it wouldn't be all austere and contemplative, that there are these moments. There's a little Jeanne Cannes piece, which is charming. And the Scarlatti is funny, the role of wit in music. Not irrelevant. There's a lot of wit in the Monteverdi also. There's two Italian madrigals in there. Both of which are, of course, about love and loss, and one is it's more or less dance. Sounds almost a little like a rock and roll at times. And the other one is this wandering, meandering Gesualdo with all the harmonies sort of oozing from one to the other, and you can feel the kind of the oozing emotion. So I wanted that juxtaposition, two Italian masters. Yeah.
Then in the second half, we have sort of the calmness and familiarity of Mozart, and then Beethoven puts the end to that pretty quickly.
Yeah. Well, this is the problem with rocketing through music history in 80 minutes, is that, so I tried to capture the equipoise, the moment of classical, you know, between 1770 and 1810, this balance. So the Mozart is this magical little bubble of time in which everything seems to react upon itself and everything comes back to this simplicity. And then the Beethoven is the same language, but now completely disrupted. And so those are the forces in that style. That's the amazing thing about Mozart, Haydn, and Beethoven. They wrote in a style that had instability built into it, but the style was about balance and repose and charm and grace, but there's also this revolutionary part. So I tried to capture all that in two pieces.
And then we have those two enemies of the Romantic era, Wagner and Brahms, represented back to back.
That's my favorite juncture, and I think the most, I hope for everyone, obviously expressive of a crucial moment in music history, which is you're coming to the end of the 19th century. All these romantics have been writing unbelievable pieces, and there's a certain style of writing, and the harmonies get more and more wild as the century goes on, and at a certain point people begin to realize that you can't stretch harmony more than you already have. You've got a taffy and it's no longer, right? So Wagner is kind of the apotheosis of that, right? And with Tristan, which is on the album, you have this chromatic harmony and you don't have as much a sense that there's any center to the harmony anymore. There's no less of a sense that the piece is in a key. It just keeps sliding from key to key. And then Brahms, right afterwards, in the same key, which is very intentional, another piece towards the end of his life, which is about sliding loss of a language, loss of harmony. You know, at the beginning, these kind of oozing thirds. And there's a waltz in there which represents kind of loss again and something that can't quite be recovered. And then we pass from the Brahms to the Schoenberg, right there at that moment. Also with a B at the beginning of the Schoenberg. So you have Wagner, Brahms, the two enemies of the 19th century, both describing the collapse of harmony, and then Schoenberg takes us over the edge, and then we're atonal. And then what do? There's this sense of almost a subconscious wandering in the Schoenberg. It's like all the forces of romanticism are suddenly wandering the zoo. They've been let out of their cages, and then they go do all these crazy things unleashed, if that makes any sense to you.
I'm curious, how did the audience react to this recital, hearing all this from start to finish? Did you get feedback?
I mean, it's obviously something to listen to that many, many styles in one night. And people read their own messages into it. I guess that's an important part of it too, you know. Like I talk a lot about the sense of loss and each style, you know, the ephemerality of human thought in this music. But then for other people it was just like a kind of a magical journey through these amazing pieces, one after the other, building on the last. And I think both of those are great.
So the story is the history of music, but it's also the cycle of life.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's what I was aiming for in some way or another, on a grand scale, you know, style, which just seems like a heartless word, but it isn't. Like, how do we choose to express ourselves? This was one of the hardest recitals I ever had to play in my life, because switching styles every 4 minutes is is just an unbelievable thing to do in front of people. Yeah? And a lot of styles that I'm not used to playing in, you know. I haven't spent that much time with medieval music. You know, I just have this affection for it. I hear these amazing sounds in it. And it was a joy to be able to play those sounds and try to make sense of them.
What did you learn about yourself in putting together this program and having to execute it?
It was funny. Each night there were certain moments that felt like the greatest, most... Like history would seem to accumulate energy and meaning at a different point each night. Which is funny. Yeah. Certain pieces seemed like the most important pieces. So it was like a different view of history each time that I played it.
Now, what about when you listen to the recording, now that you put it all together in this sort of definitive form? When you listen to it now, where do you see the high point being?
Well, all the pieces on the album are at a very high level of piece. So you hate to rate them, you know. I did organize the. So sometimes I think of the bird as a kind of a moment of great achievement. But I'm in love with William Byrd, a great English composer, and I think he's way underplayed, you know. Obviously, the chromatic fantasy and fugue, no matter... There's this sense of standing on top of a great colossus when you're playing it, and that piece always, you know. And then, weirdly, the... One of my favorite places to play in the recital was between the Stockhausen, which is this hardcore serialist piece in which every pitch and dynamic is controlled by some mathematical, and then the Philip Glass, which is exactly the opposite. It's like telling Stockhausen to go, you know, jump in a lake. and that sense of the two styles facing each other, and they both have a certain integrity to them, and they both acquire meaning, and I felt that they acquired more meaning next to each other, weirdly, even though they didn't belong together.
And there was a certain sense of relief when the Philip Glass followed.
Yes.
I will just say.
Stockhausen is the end of a certain line, you know? It's like the hardest, the serialism, this is a like whole process of thinking about music. And Philip Glass says, oh, no, that line is, we're done with that. Let's do something else.
Yeah, let's take a deep breath now and
gather
ourselves.
Let's find a different way. Yeah.
Let's talk just a little bit about your latest writing project, which is the book that you have been working on for a while, apparently.
Yes, an amazingly long time. But I have this day job, piano playing, that is demanding of my time. So I did a piece in The New Yorker about piano lessons and about my teacher when I was 12 and my teacher when I was more or less 22, sort of two important teachers. And you know, gratifyingly, a lot of people read it and were moved by it. And I was trying to write this love letter to them both. So I got a book contract out of that article, and I've been writing a rather larger account of various piano lessons. I had a lot of teachers who were serious and some were hilarious, and a lot of incredibly either sort of dark stories or funny, joyful stories, and I've been trying to tell them in a way that everyone can appreciate, you know, how it is that I got here through those people's advice, and sometimes like navigating them like a reef or a shoal, like what advice to take, what advice to ignore, or how to survive certain kinds of teaching. And so that's, and then some of it is a little bit about music, just like me talking about why, what in music is so important to me.
What is important?
There's a lot of different things.
What's the first thing that comes to your mind when someone says, why is music important to you?
Well, music is like an emotional transformation of time. You know, it's like a way of experiencing the moment, being in focused and concentrated in the moment. And this can be charged with various light and dark feelings, and then the way the pieces operate. And other things that composers, in a way, write pieces. This is going to sound a little weird, but when they write a piece, it's almost like a little piece of artificial intelligence they're creating. It's like a little code, and it imitates us. You know, pieces get excited like we do, and they get despairing and wondering, and they become uncertain like we do. You know, there's so much in music that is meant to be almost like ourselves, separated from ourselves, if that makes sense. And so when you're in it, it's like you're released from yourself into this other world.
Do you think the same is true if you had written that piece of music? Or is it because you're playing music that others have written?
I think the same is true. I think Beethoven was pretty released from his miseries and sorrows when he was writing great music. I would like to think that.
I also think that music sort of suspends time.
Mm-hmm. Yes, it does. That's one of the many things it does with time. It can make time feel intense or needy or suspenseful, of course, and then it can make it feel endless. You know, we were listening in the car the other day to this famous place in Brahms' Second Piano Concerto in the Supplement, where Brahms creates one of the great suspended times. And that's in the book, a big passage about that particular place and why it's so important.
Is there one story you can share with us about one of your piano teachers?
One story about one of my piano teachers. Wow.
Maybe something that when we read it in the book, we'll be like, really? That really happened?
Wait, what about one of my Juilliard chamber music coaches? This is a great story. There's a legend named Felix Galimir, who was in his 90s by that point and fairly frail. And we came into play one of the great pieces of the Beethoven Archduke Trio, the Slevament. And there we were, these little whippersnappers trying to play this profound piece. And I start in, and he comes over to me, he says, this is the only place in all of music where the piano actually sounds beautiful. And he's like, because he hated pianos mostly. And then we play it, and then he says, slower, slower, slower. So I play again. Bum, 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 slower! So then I'm playing eventually this unbelievably glacial pace. And my two fellow musicians are sitting there staring at me, like, how are we going to get through this piece? I get through the theme slowly, and I don't dare to play any faster. And we get to the first variation, we look over, and he's completely asleep. So we soothed him to sleep. So that was my first experience with the legendary Felix Galimir. Yeah.
Thank you. When is the book due out? Do you know? This year, next year?
That's a horrible question to ask a writer, of course. When it's finished, I guess.
Okay.
The thing is, I'm going to say this, and I think it's true. My editor, he was very happy with all the first drafts that I sent in, and he had a lot of comments. And I think he's felt that the process of writing it has been a gradual purifying and refining. So he's very patient about it. At least I think he still is. So I hope in the next 6 months it will be done.
All right. Well, keep us posted.
Yes.
I didn't know if you were under a contract. And
the deadline whizzed by years ago.
Jeremy Denk, spanning 700 years of Western classical music. That's New Classical Tracks from American Public Media, with special thanks to Valerie Kaler for producing this episode. I'm Julia Macher.